Hello and welcome to another new Taking Care of Business Live in the RPPFM studios. I'm Jackie Mitchell. Great you could join us today as we discuss the latest buzzword in business, neuroscience. The application of neuroscience, psychology to marketing is now the norm, not the exception. So today we dive in to understand this area further with Australia's leaders in the field. Today's brainstorm is brought to you by our friends at eView Real Estate. As we talk to the best brains about brains, I'm ably assisted by the brainiac himself and the voice of God, Warwick Merry. Hello.
I'm not sure about the best brain in the business, but I've got a brain and sometimes I use it, sometimes I don't. You just ask my wives, they'll tell you.
It's good to have you back. You've just come back from a very exciting trip to the US.
Lovely to be back. Yeah, we had a month. We did 6,500 kilometres driving around, and that is a very interesting country to be in at this time.
I bet it is. Yes. Back to work or business related, you did do a little bit of business
definitely.
Over there.
Yeah, definitely.
So tell us what you did.
So there was a conference in the middle of America at Colorado Springs in Denver.
Yep.
And so there was there with a load of certified speaking professionals, of which I am one. It's a global certification. And so we were basically talking about how do we progress our business. And I got to tell you, one of the topics I'm sure we'll talk about today is the biggest barrier to business is the one that's between your ears. But it's the joy of it is it's also the one thing that you can reframe or retrain or work with. So it was very good. And there was a whole lot of meetings all around the place with people always trying to drum up business, as small businesses do. Wherever you go, there's always the conversation about how can I add value to this situation.
What was the biggest tip that you got out of it?
Oh, the biggest tip and the thing I walked away with is I'm doing pretty well.
It's good confidence.
Is that affirmation that it's like I'm on track. And as look, it takes 16 to 20 years to be an overnight success.
Yeah.
And in small business, it's like sometimes it feels like you're doing the same thing every day, and sometimes you are. But it's to go to the States and look at people who I thought, oh, these guys are the best in the world. And I'm like, whoa, I'm actually ahead of them in some ways. As an example, our banking system in Australia, it rocks. You go over there and they're just getting chips in their credit cards. The whole PayWave thing or whatever, they got no idea about that.
Yeah.
They still write checks. Who writes checks?
Yeah, Australians do embrace technology very well.
Big time, big time. Yeah, very much so. And I think we're also very good at putting ourselves down and saying, oh, other people are better or other people are better.
Yeah, I don't like
and,
that.
And we actually do very well in many, many things.
We do. And we're also pretty good at putting other people down, that tall poppy syndrome.
Oh, very much so. So today is all about keeping ourselves lifted and how fabulous we are.
Well, I think we need to be talking about our brain a bit more. It's interesting. I don't think we talk about it enough.
No. And it's the kind of, and this is you and I was having this discussion with Professor Joseph beforehand. If you look at the stimulus that we get or stimuli that we get each day and age now, it is very negative. The news is all about fear and what's, you know, the television that we watch is really brain numbing. So where is the stuff that actually stimulates? And one of my favorite TV shows is The West Wing because it was entertaining and it was clever. The first couple of seasons of Big Bang Theory, entertaining but smart, a lot of science. And now it feels like it's just turned into Friends.
Yeah.
So there is something to be said for you've got to have that stimulation.
Yeah.
There's the Nito Cobain, a great speaker out of the States, said, who you spend time with is who you become. And so that's the kind of conversations that you have are the ones that will continue to stretch your brain. So if you're just rocking up doing the same thing over and over, that's what's going to happen. But if you're looking for new input, new ideas, new discussions, stretching yourself, you might not apply it, but during the process of the conversation, it's amazing the thoughts that come to you and what can happen.
That's why I love this show, not only for people listening to it, because every week we've got new guests on, different people, different topics. But I suppose from a personal perspective, it's like I go to school every Friday and I'm surrounding myself with people smarter than me.
Yeah.
And so it makes me look smarter than I actually am.
And you can also learn lessons from completely different industries.
Oh, yeah.
But you think, wow, I could do that, but just different.
Yeah, exactly. Now, speaking of Professor Joseph, he's sitting to my right here, and he's been on before. He is Professor Joseph Cicciari. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. He's giving me the thumbs up. He is from Swinburne University of Technology. He's from the Brain and Psychological Sciences Research Centre, and I'm going to say he is Australia's leading expert on neuroscience and neuromarketing. Is that reasonable, Joseph?
No, I think Professor Richard Silverstein is probably the best. He's my mentor.
Oh, okay. All right, so you're the second best.
I'm the second best.
Like the second best Marigold Hotel. That's it.
I'm taking care of business, nothing but the second best for you.
But I am the chair, the Australian chair of the Neuromarketing Science Business Association.
I think he's putting himself down a little bit. But anyway, it's wonderful to have you back, Joseph.
Thank you.
I love having you in the studio because this is a topic, as I said, that I don't think we talk enough about. But it's changing almost as much, if not more, than technology. We talk about technology a lot, always seems to be the topic for any business discussion, and how quickly and rapidly it's changing and business is changing. Well, what is changing is what we know about the brain.
Oh, exactly. We learn brand new things about the brain almost on a daily basis. For example, just the process associated with sleep, we've only just discovered that during a good night's sleep, the brain flushes out through its cerebral spinal fluid, flushes out materials that help with learning and long-term memory, and actually keeping the brain young and alive. So a good night's sleep is actually good for you. We've known that qualitatively, but in terms of what it actually does, how we can use neuroscience to measure it, we actually see that there are these cellular changes that take place. So no one knew about that a few years ago. We used to think that the brain was, you were born with so many brain cells and that's it. But the brain is an incredible tissue, the organ. It's always repairing itself. It's always reallocating resources. For example, if you are learning a brand new instrument, never played the instrument before, you have the capacity to reorganize your connections to help facilitate that, to learn how to play that. We call that neuroplasticity. And the more you do that, the more you do different things you've never done before or be exposed to things you've never been exposed to before, the brain has this capacity to like a sponge, to bring that in and incorporate that experience into your nexus of experiences. So it has incredible capacity to learn, to absorb. For example, you were saying about taking the best from people. I know of a wonderful young man, for example, at his 21st. He said that he takes the best from everyone, all the different characteristics. Well, his brain is actually doing that, how he processes that, and he does incorporate that into himself. So the brain you have today is really a wonderful device that's keeping all these memories together. It's these networks that you have now have been facilitated by your life experiences. So we should keep learning. We should keep doing different things because that's how you keep the brain going.
Are we all born with the same brain?
Yes and no. There's a lot of nature associated with how the brain learns.
Yes.
The environment, the experiences, the your parents, the love that you've been shown, for example, has an incredible facilitating capacity for brain development. For example, children without love, you can see that their brains are actually smaller. Mm. So there are obviously, nature is a big force, but genetics is a very big force too.
Okay. So when a baby is born, we're not all born with the same sort of brain. There will be genetic influences.
Absolutely. There will be some, pathways that are going to be set up because they're the basic pathways that have to be set up anyway. But it's all the extra facilitation that takes place. It's all part of that learning experience. So if you don't ever teach anything to something, it won't grow.
Mm.
It doesn't expand. So it stays small. And we actually see it from MRI data. This is imaging of the brain that shows that the brain is actually smaller.
So is that failure to thrive? Is that, I know,
absolutely. Absolutely. Failure to thrive.
Yes. Yeah. And there's been cases where, for example, drug addicts will have kids and it has an impact on the actual brain itself. So,
yes.
Which sets up for this failure to thrive actually happening. So how would you address that? So if you've got a child that hasn't been given some attention as they get older, can you, knowing that the brain is this neuroplasticity, can you then load on lots of attention and nurturing? Does it recover?
Absolutely. I mean, the research in this area has informed nursing. It has informed even government policies, for example, that you have to provide some sort of nurturing in children in dire situations. It's just so critical.
Yeah.
The establishing relationships with people who they can trust. Just being trustful of someone actually stimulates brain growth. We actually see hormones associated with brain growth. BDNF, a brain-derived neurotrophic factor, is like a stimulant, and we see that there's an increase in the stimulant with hugs,
right?
You know, with that sort of affection, and feeling that they're in a safe situation.
So we're nearly getting to that, like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
Is that supportive thing that helps brain development as well as growth of you as an individual?
Absolutely. A lot of this isn't new. I mean, we've known in psychology, for example, a lot of these, and there are various models that are used in psychology for behavior and so forth. We're just now discovering that, hang on, there's some neuroscience that backs that up.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, here's the connections in the brain. Here's the lack of integration. Here's the lack of neurotransmitter formation and regulation.
Yeah.
So there is very strong neuroscience evidence now that backs up all these very old psychological models.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is really exciting, especially when you're dealing with people.
Yeah, yeah.
And how they make decisions, which is what neuromarketing is all about.
Well, it's important for any business that customers have to make decisions, and businesses want them to make the right decisions for their business.
Yes.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. We all have brains, except the scarecrow out of The Wizard of Oz. That was Robbie Williams, in case you're wondering. The poor scarecrow. All he wanted was a brain, didn't he, Warwick Merry?
Can I tell you, just listening to that version of the song, which I've never heard before, straight away I've got the image of the scarecrow.
Like,
the triggers and the hooks are there. You don't even know they're there. That's why the brain is very handy at times.
The non-conscious processing.
We are here with Warwick Merry and Professor Joseph Cicciari, who is the second best neuroscientist in Australia. No, he's the best in our view. He's the chair, Australian chair of the, is it Neuroscience Marketing and Business Association?
Neuromarketing Science.
Neuromarketing Science and Business Association. Yeah, which is interesting. If anyone wants to go and have a look about, I'm a member. There's not many members in Australia, Joseph, is there really?
Well, it is growing, which is great. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, that's something we want to talk with.
Something
talk
we
about.
should develop further.
We need to develop further, don't we? Okay, now let's get stuck into business. During the break, I'm getting a few text messages through, and our mate at Telstra, Peter Bennett Hullen. Hi, Pete. I know he's listening, and he wants to know how to improve his brain. Well, Pete, keep listening, because we're about to talk about how to use your brain in business. And one area of neuro is neuromarketing has certainly growing in leaps and bounds, Joseph, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a concept that was created a few years back, probably about 15 years ago, but it's really coming into its own. It was quite evident at the big international conference in Dubai earlier this year that it certainly has come into its own. It's in terms of acceptance as a tool for trying to understand the consumer in terms of their decision-making, that it's not about being persuasive or manipulative. It's about trying to find out a little bit more about how they think and giving them the products and the experience that will facilitate their decision-making.
Interesting point. And I use this when I'm talking to clients from a brand perspective. And there was some research done last year, I think in Canada. It was commissioned by Microsoft. And the research was about our attention span. And our attention span apparently was 12 seconds. And the research said that it's now 8 seconds. It's gone down. A goldfish apparently is 9 seconds. So we've got an attention span less of a goldfish. And they correlated that directly to the rise of smartphones. And we're getting information so much faster. So it's actually, rewiring our brains to, lessen our attention span. And I found that really interesting. And then, and Joseph, you can certainly expand on this because you know a hell of a lot more about it than I do. But getting someone's attention, a lot of that mental processing, our brain is processing that in an unconscious part of your brain. So you don't even know, you're not even aware of the process happening. So to get, you've got, I think, 1 or 2 seconds for the unconscious to then make a decision.
No, 300 milliseconds.
300 milliseconds? So is this right?
This is at the unconscious level.
At the unconscious level, so you don't know this is happening.
But to the brain, that 300 milliseconds is a long time.
Right, that's how fast it works. But anyway, my point is, so in the unconscious, 300 milliseconds, it sort of filters whether it moves that message, whatever it is you're trying to get the attention, into your conscious level. And that's the bit that a lot of marketers don't get. So I found that really fascinating.
You can do all sorts of surveys and forums and so forth and get information. But in the end, when you have a look at how people process sensory information, the visual, the auditory, the narrative, the soundtrack, all of those have ways of adjusting the bias, so to speak, so that a person will decide that they'll like a particular product, not because of what it looked like, but the experience, the emotional experience they had with that, and that early processing that takes place.
So. It's fascinating, and I love, this is one of my favourite words, Warwick Merry, you'll like this, neuropsychoeconomics.
Give me some of that. Two bags of neuropsychoeconomics, thanks.
So it's brain economics or brain money? What is that, Joseph?
Neuropsychoeconomics is bringing together a number of fields. One is psychology and everything that psychology brings. And remember, psychology is a way of quantifying what's happening with respect to behaviours, looking at human behaviours. And neuro, of course, is bringing the neurophysiology and understanding how the brain and the body works, by the way, and how the brain actually changes aspects of the body. So, for example, you might be looking at something and your heart rate may change or your breathing patterns may change or the temperature of your forehead may change. And they are all correlated with your subconscious processes that are taking place. They're helping you with your decision making.
Yes.
So, you know, people are now using that sort of information. That was one of the things that came out of the forum, is that there are so many tools now available for people to use. You don't have to have the high-end EEG or fMRI stuff to do that.
Okay, so you don't actually need an MRI to do that?
No, you don't. No. So and the other thing is eye tracking.
What are some of the tools that you
use? Eye
tracking
is probably the best tool. Right. There are all different types of eye tracking devices. And, for example, there are some devices which plug into your iPad and they can monitor your eyes and your facial expressions while you're looking at an ad. And that information gets filtered back to the people who've put the ad together. And they find that at certain stages, this is what drew that person's attention, this particular image, this particular colour, this particular word, this particular brand drew their attention. Now, whether they put that into their memory and whether they then facilitate buying because it's in memory, these are very difficult processes to see, but you can still see those early stages. So, for example, we did some work looking at developing ads for elderly people in terms of energy saving. And we noticed that with the eye tracking alone, they tended to not look at images of elderly people doing things with fridges and light switches and so forth. And the survey that was first done suggested that they would like to see someone but doing these various behaviours in terms of this is how you save energy. But the brain stuff and the eye tracking showed that they did not want to see elderly people. They didn't want to be reminded, perhaps, that they were elderly, that they were ageing. People just did not like that. Yeah. So if you're trying to get a message across, well, you've lost them. Mm. And so eye tracking is very useful for that. As an example.
And I think that will come in handy. A lot of the business owners are listening and probably thinking, oh, this sounds quite complicated. To break it down from a business perspective, so many of the ads I see or hear or are part of is all about the individual. Look at my stuff. How good is my stuff? Buy my stuff. Buy my stuff. Mm. People don't care. They're like, and I'm sure some of their research would back it up, is like, I want to see my idealized state. So if I'm an elderly person, I don't want to see another elderly person using the fridge.
Exactly.
Because in my mind, I'm still 18.
Yeah.
So I want to see maybe a 40-year-old because I'm 60 and that's what I think my perception of how I am in the world is like that.
Yeah.
So it is about putting, make it easy for the customer to be aware of what's in it for them.
Yeah.
And your the great devices can help track what is the responses you're getting. Because, I mean, Jackie, you mentioned to me many years ago now, is that the biggest issue when it comes to marketing is noise.
Yeah.
And so there is so much noise now, and we took 300 milliseconds to just turn off. I don't need that. I don't need that. I'm looking at this billboard. Don't care. Don't care. Don't care. When I watch telly, I mute the ads because I'm not interested. But every now and again, something might catch my eye, and after a while, I'll typically for me, it's a movie trailer. Yeah. I'll go off mute so I can pay attention to it. So
that has mean it's translated or transported from your unconscious, subconscious mind, not unconscious.
Hey, sometimes it's my unconscious mind. But yeah, so from
your
from
subconscious mind into your conscious mind.
Yeah.
And then your attention span's now 8 seconds.
And so I'll now take an action going, yes, yeah. I'm interested.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, that 8 to 12 second thing,
yeah.
Very quickly, as I mentioned at the very start, our brain adapts. So, for example, if you've grown up just looking at iPads all the time, your brain is going to be tuned for iPads. Mm. It's going to be tuned for that sort of interaction. So one thing that's happening at the moment, and advertisers are very aware of this, when they're dealing with young people who are more technological, using faces, for example, using ads with faces and so forth, don't work because they don't like that. They're not tuned to that. And so you've got to develop these iPad, the apps which attract them.
Which is the gamification.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? So yeah. People are now, a lot of companies are now using gamification to sell things and to promote things and use it as an advertising tool.
And even in the conference industry, because, you know, I do a lot of MC work, it's like we're using gamification to keep people interested in what's happening in the event.
Mm.
The research we have as speakers is there has to be some kind of interactivity every 5 to 7 minutes.
Yes.
Now, the interactivity can be making them laugh. It can be having them share a learning with someone else. It can be having them pick up their phone and enter something into the conference app that's on. But there has to be somewhere that they're involved in it.
Absolutely. They need to be taken on a journey. And you've got to make that journey emotional. You've got to make it fun. You've got to have it interactive. That's what people want.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a wonderful example of a museum shop in Europe. And that what they did is they got in some neuromarketing people and they completely reorganized the store. Because they turned the store into an interactive journey. And people and sales went up 54%. Right. Yep. So they changed colours, they changed the way in which you interact, items had to be at eye level. You know, all those things that we've learned from neuromarketing, they applied it to this store and it 54% increase in sales.
Volkswagen did the same thing on a set of stairs versus escalators. And there's a video on the internet that people can look at. They turned the stairs into a piano keyboard. So all of a sudden, no one went on the escalators. They all went up because they get to play. And in the process, they're exercising, they're, you know, engaging, that kind of stuff. So it is about how do we make the customer the star of the show?
Exactly. And that's not manipulative. That's not actually, you know, brainwashing. What you're doing is you're giving the consumer an experience, which is good for them, yes, of course, but at the same time, they enjoy it.
Yes.
And if they enjoy it, there's an emotional engagement. If there's emotional engagement, they'll say, I want to come back to this store.
Yep.
My brain is hungry for more. We hope you're enjoying eavesdropping on our interesting conversation and getting inspired. Our next guest certainly is a source of inspiration for many people, and she is going to share with us some secrets to unlocking the creative spaces in your brain. She's the founder of Creative Universe, Creative Innovation Global, and Creativity Australia, Tanya De Jong. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, very good talking with you. Tanya, how does singing change the brain?
Well, it's an absolute miracle, actually. What happens is when you sing, and particularly when you sing with other people, the right temporal lobe of your brain fires up. The neural pathways connect in new and different ways, and you release all these incredible endorphins like oxytocin, the hormone responsible for pleasure, love, and bonding. And so when you sing with other people, your brain is firing in such a way that you become healthier, happier, smarter and more creative. It improves your memory, language and concentration. And it's also been known to heal people from strokes, depression and a whole range of other things. So it's like a super duper wonder drug.
Oh, God, that's very inspiring. Now, speaking of which, you've just launched recently a new co-working hub in South Melbourne called, I think it's Dimension 5. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so Dimension 5 is a joint venture with Dimension Data, which is the global IT company, and Creative Universe, my company. And it's been set up to inspire game changers, entrepreneurs, startups, not-for-profit, small businesses, and small teams from larger businesses to come together in an 1,100 square metre space in South Melbourne to collaborate, incubate, co-create, and create some wonderful new ventures and grow some existing ventures so that we can solve particularly more of the social issues that we're facing as a community. I'm particularly passionate about social enterprise and social innovation, so, you know, setting up enterprises to solve things like, you know, poverty and domestic violence and loneliness. Loneliness in particular is the epidemic of our time. So there's a lot of people who need to get together and sing with others and need to get together and feel more positive about the world and find more of a purpose and meaning in life.
Certainly co-working is a rising trend, and it's been said that it's a key ingredient to foster innovation. Is that your experience?
Yes, definitely. You know, people in general find it hard to innovate completely on their own. I mean, you need feedback and you need people that are going to challenge you. So in general, innovation occurs at the intersection, at what I call the positive human collisions. And when you bring together people who are very diverse on a regular basis to take you out of your comfort zone, as opposed to being in your comfort zone with people who think and act like you do and have similar backgrounds in education. When you actually connect with people who are very diverse on a regular basis, that's when innovation truly starts to spark. And so in these co-working spaces, if they're curated with a lot of diversity, you are in a space where you can get this real positive human collisions happening on a daily basis, and people get stimulated in different ways, and that's when innovation starts to spark. You get what is called creative abrasion happening.
I love the positive human collisions. I think that's that's a wonderful term. How do you unlock more of your creative leadership potential in your brain?
Well, singing is a really, really good way because when you sing, it takes you into the right side of your brain, and the right side of your brain is like your battery charger. Now, unfortunately, we spend most of the time in the left side of our brain being overwhelmed by too many facts, you know, figures, logical sort of thinking, analytical thinking. But when we actually connect to the right side of our brain, which is houses our intuitive and imaginative and creative functions, that's when we really start to function as human beings and not as robots or machines. And so a lot of the time we don't spend enough time in that part. And, well, singing's great for that, but so is meditation, you know, walking in nature, cuddling your dog, being with your loved ones, just connecting beyond what I call beyond the boxes. I have a TED Talk, as you know, called How Singing Together Changes the Brain, and I talk about connecting beyond the boxes. We spend a lot of our lives, you know, thinking in a box, filling in boxes and all of that. And this is about going beyond the boxes, and it's beyond the boxes where we unlock our creative potential as a human being. And there's a lot of studies done that show that, you know, children exhibit 98% creative behaviour, reducing to just 2% by the time we're 25 years old. But we do still have all of that creative potential within us. We're just not unleashing it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Tanya, if someone wants to have a look at your TED Talk, where would they find that?
So if you look up Tanya De Jong, so it's T-A-N-I-A-D-E, capital J-O-N-G, so two words, D-E space J-O-N-G, TED Talk, you'll find it. And it's just ticked over 30,000 views, so it's going, a lot of global interest in it. And as a result of it, if people watch to the end, they'll see the work we're doing with our With One Voice program, which is the social inclusion program where we bring together, you know, more fortunate people with less fortunate people in choirs of social inclusion. And they'll see all about positive human collisions and thinking beyond the box and unleashing more creative potential. So that's my TED Talk, or from my website, Tanya De Jong, T-A-N-I-A-D-E-J-O-N-G.com. that website or creativeuniverse.com.au, which is where all my different enterprises sit on.
Fantastic. That's wonderful. We'll actually put the TED Talk link to our Facebook page. Really appreciate your time this morning. And I wish you all the very best for Dimension 5 and all those 100 other little enterprises that are all involving positive human collisions.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you so much. It is all about breaking down the barriers between us and building bridges between us. So
that's a nice way to finish. Tanya De Jong, thank you very much. Good morning.
Thank you.
We're getting lots of brainy information here from the best in the business world. I'm here with Warwick Merry and Professor Joseph Chachari talking about creativity, Joseph. That is an interesting area that the brain...
Absolutely.
You know, how can we foster creativity? And we talked about, Tanya was talking about co-workplaces.
Yeah. It's about developing the environment where you nurture
it.
Right. Unfortunately, we don't do that. Mm. We don't like people to be too creative, stand out, and we tend to chop them down. The Americans do a wonderful job with respect to those creative children and giving them an environment where they can be creative. Creativity is a wonderful process that can be measured with neuroscience. Yes, it is to a certain extent a lot to do with the right hemisphere, but there's a lot of wonderful connections that take place. For example, one of my colleagues created, from marketing, created this wonderful survey instrument which broke people down into four categories or four personality orientations. And one of them is the imaginative. And we did an fMRI study and we found that those networks in an imaginative thinking person was all right hemisphere. But at the same time, they could solve problems faster because they had that imaginative component compared to others who do not have those networks. So we have people who, from nature, who are generally imaginative, but anyone can learn how to be that as well.
How can you
simply by putting them into a creative environment, that interacting with different types of people? I'll give you an example. Right. We've at Swinburne, we've just restructured our whole university, and we have the Faculty of Health, Arts, and Design. Now, I'm actually working with design people and engineers now that I never would have even thought of dealing with at all, and we have come up with two major solutions to some health issues in India. And that would not have happened had we not got together that way. I'm the neuro person, but the design people, the engineers, the people who create as well, but they use a different process of creation. And by looking at a problem, we can solve a problem from different directions. And so that's why Swinburne's organising itself to have also an innovations precinct where we work with industry and be creative and come up with, nurture that creativity. From an industry, from a commercial point of view. But at the same time, when you bring different thinking styles together, you actually get great outcomes.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And because we're born with a preference, is that right, for whether we're left or right brain?
Well, not really.
Or not?
Not really, okay. No. It really is associated with what sort of life you're having, what school you went to, what friends you had.
Yep.
That sort of sets the scene for that.
Ah.
So if you had, now I can think of a high school teacher who had the biggest impact on me. He taught completely off the teaching curriculum, and he was so different and he was so creative. He's the one I remember. And to a certain extent from my high school years, he's the one who actually put me on in the direction that I've taken.
Wow.
Yeah. So an individual who's so different yet can have such a big impact, 30 years later.
Yeah, well, that's something.
I think there's a lot to be said in that. I don't think you're like right or left. Like there is that flexibility.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Creativity loves structure.
Yeah.
Like there is something like you look at anyone who creates, be they artisans or musicians or whatever, they love a structure. The musicians, this one is a 4-4 song. And every now and again, we're going to throw a 3-4 bar
absolutely.
In there. But there is the structure. But within that, you can do anything. So there is that... There is a need, or there is at the very least room for both.
Yeah, absolutely.
And So we can talk more.
Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking if you're in a situation, a work situation, you know, it's a brainstorming session, for instance, hint the term brainstorming, of course. And you're thinking, oh, I'm not very creative, and you talk yourself out of being creative.
Mm.
Are there some things that we can do for that session, get, okay, my right brain, come on. Wake up. What, you know, should I be watching a cartoon?
Smack yourself in the right side of the head really hard.
You know, is there something, you know, should I be watching cartoons? Should I be singing a song?
Yeah.
Is there things I can do to
Absolutely.
Get that activated? Like,
yeah.
What can
like
I do?
Said from the very start, you do things you've never done before. So we don't ever have only one side working. They're all working.
Yeah, of course.
They're all contributing in some way.
Yeah.
And of course, you'll have a dominant process taking place in one side or another side, depending on what's happening. But those people who are creative tend to rely on all of their resources, and they can efficiently use left and right. There may be a control center on the right, so to speak, but they can very efficiently make those decisions.
I love that.
They use all their resources. Mm. Yeah. They don't just box themselves into a corner and say, I'm only going to deal with the facts, right?
Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating stuff. Now, when we come back after this break, I want to chat about how to improve your memory. Now, that can help not only in your day-to-day, but also from a business perspective. When you're marketing your business or selling your business, it's critical that your customers remember your brand, remember the name of your business, remember what the message is you're trying to sell or communicate. So we're going to talk a little bit about how to improve the memory of yourself and also to make your customers remember who you are. We are talking all about our minds, suspicious or not, our brains and how we can make them work a little bit better. And one area of the brain that a lot of businesses, in my experience, don't understand enough about is your memory. And it impacts so many elements of your business, from remembering people's names at networking events to customers remembering your business name and your brand name, so then they can then refer and recommend to their friends, which is a very important part of social media these days. So, Joseph, what are some quick tips of how we can improve our memory?
Well, with any function that we have, the best thing to do is actually exercise it. So you do little memory charts, and you do little make little lists and memorize the lists and so forth. So you're exercising that system. So that's probably one of the best ways of doing it. But like I said from the very start, if you're learning how to play an instrument, there's so many things you have to remember, and that is stimulating those memory systems and hopefully putting it all into long-term memory. But sleep is very good for memory. People have, if they're having good night's sleep on a regular basis, their memory capacity is far more than those who have, very poor quality sleep.
That's why I've got a good memory, because I'm known for my sleep, bit of a sleep guru. But one of the things with memory that I use a lot is that it's much easier to remember something if you can attach it to an existing memory already established in your brain.
I use limericks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And it's almost like the same thing, Warwick, we're talking about remembering people's names. Mm. When I meet someone for the first time, I automatically think of someone else I know with the same name. So whether that person, I know them personally, or it could be a movie star, or it could be a character in a book or something, but I attach it to them. So when I see them again, I see the picture of the person that I know, which is the existing memory, until I get to a point where it's created its own memory.
So, and other people will do little tricks like if someone introduces you, you say then one of the first words you say is their name again, or you use their name a couple of times, or you create some hooks, like you go visualize really stupid things that sort of help create a stronger hook.
Yeah. But
do they work, or
are they? Absolutely. You know your own memory. You know how it works. It's strengths. Mm. And so you use those strengths. Mm. So, for example, when I do exactly that, going to a conference and trying to remember as many names, I repeat the name.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I attach a visual memory associated with it.
So, because the pop psychology says that the brain works in images. Is that correct? Like, are the images easier to... Like, mine seems to be full of music. Like, whenever someone will say a sentence and bam, there's a lyric and I'm singing the song next breath. Yeah. So, is it more in these kind of constructs?
It depends on how your brain has wired itself up over the years, your experiences. If you tend to be more visual, you'll have more visual imagery associated with memories, associated with events and so forth. Whereas, I mean, we know this from work in PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, what people actually remember and how they remember. So, for example, if you're using getting them to remember a list of words or a list of images, you'll find that anything associated with sort of a trauma experience, they will tend to not remember those words or those images as well.
Right.
Or they'll be very vivid for them.
Okay.
Yeah. And you get a very strong emotional response associated with it.
And this is where great brands actually use that technique.
Oh, absolutely.
So you think about brand names, and one of the things that really grinds my gears when a new business or someone starting a new business and they're looking at a brand name is they use acronyms, you know, XYZ. And I say to them, you know what, it's not impossible, but you're making it very difficult because there's nothing existing in a person's memory, in a customer's memory, that they're going to attach that to.
Mm.
So a shortcut would be coming up with the brand name that already means something in the customer's mind.
Mm. Yeah, we did some research where we looked at imagery of brands, as in the actual logo, and we found that young people remembered the image. They didn't remember the words.
Yeah,
or
so that the swoosh or the Nike swoosh.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and there's a lot of brands also that have sounds or noises that are associated with it. Like Intel has that ding-ding-ding-ding that's on all their ads.
Yeah.
Taking Care of Business has the Taking Care of Business song at the start and the end of the show. But again, it's like we're consistent with it. It doesn't change. And this is why I think brands have challenges when they do a brand refresh. And Instagram has just changed their logo.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible.
And people are making judgments left, right, and saying, oh, it's terrible. Oh, my God, I can't believe they've done it.
It is,
But I reckon give it 6 months and it'll be like, what was their old one again? So it's it is about how do we do our logo or our brand changes?
You know what it is, because it's creating discomfort in our brain because we've established associations and images that we're comfortable with
and
associated
now I have to work
with that brand.
Shift it. And the change is so subtle. Like it's just gone from being sort of an image, which is what they do, to being like a drawing more of a thing. So we have to fight our brain to recognize, no, this is Instagram now.
You ever wondered why they did that?
No, no idea.
Yeah, it had to do with the younger market.
Right.
In terms of how they process imagery.
Right, so it's all about its iconography is something that they can grab onto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. I like that.
So old farts like us, not that you're old, Jackie, but other people, we struggle with it because we're like, oh, but it's a nice photo and that's what I like.
Yeah, but we don't like change. But if we do it, eventually accept it, it's actually good for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point as well. Now, neurofeedback, Professor Joseph, I just wanted to touch on that. What is it? I keep hearing about it everywhere.
Neurofeedback is a technique associated with biofeedback, that you're recording biological signals from the body or the brain, and you're feeding that back to the person as some sort of scale or some sort of colour, and the person has to try and learn how to manipulate that dial or that colour. And we've found that in depression and a variety of other disorders, attention disorders and so forth, that neurofeedback, recording from the brain, and that brain signal, let's say alpha activity, has a little rocket associated with it. And when you're thinking and you're increasing your alpha activity, the little rocket goes up. So children who have a bit of a problem with attention, that can actually help facilitate growth, development. So we don't actually know what's changing, but the brain is rewiring itself in such a way that, yes, you're going to be producing more alpha activity. And with depression, we found that that's quite useful too, because, yes, it increases theta activity in particular. And we know that there are brain hormones which are secreted, which help with reallocation of resources, but also growth of centers. So we see a decrease in the symptoms associated with depression. But people are using neurofeedback for cognitive decline. And there've been some and helping people who are anxious how to relax, and they're very, very good. We actually assessed one particular commercial device recently, which measured EEG, and it was just a band you put on the forehead, and it coupled to your smartphone or your iPad, and it played your music and had this beautiful visual imagery associated with it. And we found that people's heart rate came down, their blood pressure came down, they felt more relaxed. But at the same time, their cognitive abilities improved,
right,
which was interesting.
Yeah.
You know, they could remember more. Talk about memory again. They could remember more. So good outcomes.
So it's the kind of thing, it sounds like it's the whole management principle of what gets measured gets improved. So we're trying to measure what are the issues that we want to deal with and then it's somehow shifting our processes so that we can better manage that.
Yeah, it's just stimulating the brain.
Yeah.
Just getting the brain to do stuff.
Yeah.
And that helps repair it, fix it, reorganize it, and even growth, this neural plasticity.
That's a nice way to finish up because we've run out of time. I hate that. Wish we had a lot more talking about the brain. But, of course, I know that Joseph will come back. He's come back a second time, so we'd love to have him back for a third time. We could just keep discussing. Because I want to talk about imposter syndrome next time.
Next time.
If you want to know about that, you can Google it in the meantime. But it's an interesting syndrome, particularly for entrepreneurs.
And so many people have.
Have it. That's right, exactly. But we're going to reveal a bit more about that next time. I'd like to thank a very special guest today, Professor Joseph Ciciari from Swinburne University.
Thanks, Jackie. This
I
love, is great.
Love is having great. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for allowing us to learn from you.
Oh, thank you.
Warwick Merry, always a Merry.
Always delightful.
Always
a pleasure here on Taking Care of Business.
My brainiac sidekick.
Oh, that's working.
And also our special guest today, Tanya De Jong. She's created Dimension 5. We'll put a link to our Facebook page if you're interested in finding out more. You can always join us, the discussion on Facebook. And we look forward to your company next Friday at 11 a.m. In the meantime, keep being brainy and taking care of your business.